Okay, as usual, any questions? Yes.
One question. So I remember we parametrized the history with lambda, and then later on you mentioned that it's a natural way to say that lambda is tau, right?
Well, you can, one particular choice of lambda could be tau.
But it's not special by any means.
It is very special.
It is special, okay.
Yeah, so. So let's forget about Lorentz and so on. If I'm I want to write down a curve in R2, I can. If I'm lucky, this will be a graph, and I can write y of x. But in general, this thing can be anything. And in this case, I can often find some nice parametrization where I use an external parameter to write it. Now, this external parameter is pretty much irrelevant. What you really care is the value of x and y at the fixed value of theta, not so much which theta you're choosing. So here is the same. This lambda is the same as this theta. So you can change it as you like. Now, what is the analog of proper time here? The analog of proper time here is the arc length of this curve. So you're saying that from theta 0 to theta here, you move precisely an amount theta minus theta 0 measured in meters. So it is a special choice of parametrization. It's not arbitrary. It's related to the geometry of your curve. There is the same proper time. It's not so much a distance measured in meters, but is a time, because your curve is moving. It's a time-like curve, and so what makes sense to measure is the time elapsed between two points. But is the time elapsed not in an inertial frame? Is the time elapsed with respect to the observer traveling along that trajectory? So you can't know a priori what your parameter is. To be able to write, if you're solving an equation of motion or something like that, you will not know often how to parameterize this in terms of arc length until you're done at the end. So when you do this action thing, you pick an arbitrary parameter, you do your equations of motion, and then you compute the proper time.
And then you can go back.
Yeah. Because I can write it like this, and it seems that there is nothing to vary here. But it's not true, because tau, the very definition of tau, depends on the curve that I'm traveling on. So you have to make it explicit, and then compute things. Like, vary the action, and so on. And at the end, you can say, it's a bit like saying, the action is this, but the Hamilton's function for the action is the proper time along that trajectory. You have to compute it on shell at the end, and you find that this is now for that. So did you try to compute the equations of motion for this one? So let's do it quickly. We have already done it for this piece. And one found So let's see, d over d lambda, dl over d gamma prime mu, minus dl over d gamma mu. So first one is d over d lambda of m gamma mu prime divided by minus gamma mu prime, gamma mu prime. So this we computed last time. It comes from this piece. Then we have the second piece. And derivative with respect to gamma mu prime gives us q a mu at gamma. Minus, where does gamma appear? Gamma appear only in here, in within A. So we need so we get Q. Now let's see. Gamma prime nu, which is the one that is already there, and then A nu divided by dx mu, and then we get d, computed at x equal gamma. Am I doing it right, I think? Yeah, I think so. Okay.
Well, why couldn't you write just DID gamma?
You can, it's just, it's not, because this is more like A of x, because A is defined everywhere, and so it's defined, you derive it in x, not in gamma, and then you evaluate it at gamma. So this is, it's like the chain rule. You have f of y of x, you don't write df over dx, you write df over dy times dy over dx. In this case, we're not deriving gamma any farther, but we will see it in a second here exactly how this goes. So this we recognize to be p mu. So this is d over d lambda p mu plus q. Again, chain rule. So we derive d a mu by dx nu, evaluated at x equal gamma, and then derive gamma nu by d lambda. But this is nothing else than gamma prime nu. Minus q gamma prime nu dA nu over dx mu. So collecting everything together, we get d over d lambda p mu plus q gamma. Well, let's see, where do we want to put this? We get gamma prime nu multiplying d nu a mu minus d mu a nu. So this is, now it's by multiplying by these kind of factors, we can convert these derivatives into derivatives with respect to proper time. And since this is equal to zero, it doesn't really matter. So what we get is p mu dot. So this is with respect to proper time, plus q gamma dot nu, and then d nu a mu minus d mu a nu. So this is the equation of motion we get. And now we have an anti-symmetric two tensor. So this is, we will see, this is, of course, the electromagnetic tensor. So, and this is the Lorentz force. So this is a specific example, which we were missing last time, of a relativistic equation of motion where the force is also a four vector. And here is obtained by contracting this rank 2 covariant tensor with the four velocity of our. So I can even call this maybe u nu, right? It's a bit more evocative, with the four velocity of my. Yeah, of my trajectory. One nice consequence of this law, which is not complete, which is not granted a priori in special relativity, is that remark, d over d tau of minus m squared is what? Is, maybe I put 1/2 over here. Remember, m squared is the same as p squared. So this is p mu times that, times so this is the same as doing this, which on shell will be this p mu, well, there is a q, then p mu u nu, just let me call that thing f, well, doesn't matter, d nu a mu minus d mu, okay? But since p mu and u nu are proportional, this is also the same as minus m q, well, let's write it like this, q m mu. So this, of course, is p. So this is symmetric in mu and nu. This is anti-symmetric in mu and nu. And so their contraction must be zero. So it means that this, the Lorentz force does not alter the mass of my particle, which is not an obvious conclusion in relativity. Yes?
When we derived the Euler-Lagrange equations, we didn't like consider any dependence of the mass in the Lagrangian on anything. So I feel like if we found a dependence, that would just be a contradiction with what we assumed. Because this mass is the same mass, right?
Oh, I would have to think about it, but in any case, it's consistent to do this. This is at least proof that it is consistent.
Yeah.
So you can, if I give you the Lorentz force, you can conclude that, and then say, oh, this equation comes from this action computed in that way. So it's consistent. Okay. Okay, good. So, now, we will come back to the Lorentz force in a moment. Today, we're looking at Maxwell equations. Which is also, of course, electrodynamics. Okay, so let's start from the Maxwell equation written in vectorial form. The way Maxwell, well, Maxwell didn't write them this way, but certainly not in the relativistic notation. So this is called Gauss law. This doesn't really have a name. I would say this is Faraday's law. And this is Ampere law with the Maxwell term. So Maxwell realized that for consistency, one has to add this term. But in magnetostatic, where there is no time dependence, one gets Ampere law without that. So we will see immediately what kind of consequence this term has. And then this is not enough to do electrodynamics. One also needs to say not only how my electromagnetic fields are sourced by the electric charge density. So this is the electric charge density, and this is the electric current. But one also, and this is, turns out, the speed of light. But also how the particles that will contribute to these densities are affected by the electromagnetic field, and this is the Lorentz force. And written in vectorial form, this is the Lorentz force is Q E time plus V cross B. Okay, so this tells me what kind of force acts on a charged particle of charge Q subjected to the and velocity V subjected to the fields electromagnetic field E and B. Now, the first consequence one notices about this is the continuity equation, which makes very clear why one needs this term for consistency. So if we take the divergence of these, so let's call them 1, 2, 3, and 4. I'm taking the divergence of 4 and plugging in 1. So I take divergence of 4. And use 1. So what happens? I get 0 on the left-hand side equal 1 over C, 4 pi divergence of J, plus d over dt of the divergence of E. So since our space derivatives, and this is partial derivatives, and this is a time partial derivative, they commute. And now this is nothing else but 4 rho. And so we get that the time derivative of rho plus the divergence of J is equal to 0. And this is the continuity equation. For the electric charge. So we will now see that this is equivalent to charge conservation. Any question about, has any question about these manipulations with, you're used to it? Okay. So we start by defining the electric charge Q in a region R of space. So this is the integral of rho. And the picture I want you to have is this one. Mine is this one, so I have x. 1, x3. Here we put time. And I want to take a region R, evolve it in time. So this is R at time t0. This is R at time t1. And this is the space-time in between. We will call it M. So in the region R at time t, we get this is the total electric charge in R. Then we define the flux through the boundary of the region R, which is the integral over dr of, now we have a 2D boundary, and we have n dot j, and n is the normal to the boundary here in space, if that makes sense. Well, maybe this is not the best. And so this is the flux of the current outside, outgoing flux of the electric current. And if we integrate these over the region R, we see that integrate continuity equation in dr, we get d over dt of qr plus the integral over r of the divergence of j, which is equal to, so this is zero. We get the time derivative plus the flux of the current is equal to zero. So this is telling us that the time derivative of, well, I could even put a total derivative here. So the time derivative of the electric charge contained in this region changes in time by an amount given by minus the flux. So it tells that it's charge conservation in the sense that it's a balance equation between, tells us how much charge is lost to the outgoing flux. So this is a balance equation, which is another way of talking about charge conservation. Of course, if you include the entire universe, nothing can go out, so the total charge is conserved. This boundary is at infinity, nothing goes through a boundary at infinity, and so this term vanishes, and one gets that the total charge in the universe is conserved. In particular, and this is, one gets that qr at time 1 minus qr at time 0 becomes the integral from t0 to t1, minus the integral from t0 to t1 of this flux. So you can think of these as the leakage term of how much is flowing out, how much charge is flowing out. Any questions? Okay. Then next, here we took the divergence of this equation and used that one in. Now we take the curl of 3 and 4, and we'll find the wave equation for ENB. So this is extremely important. So if you have doubts, please come see me later, or ask a question now. That's also fine, of course. So what do we get? The curl of a curl is a little annoying, but the point is that the curl, we start from the curl of E plus 1 over C dB over dt. So this gives us the gradient of the divergence of E minus the Laplacian of E . So again, this is a scalar because it's a divergence, so I can take a gradient. And here I'm just, let me define this symbol. The Laplacian is this symbol squared in a way. So it is dx squared plus dy squared plus dz squared. So for every component of V, I'm taking its Laplacian. And then I have over here 1 over c d over dt, the curl of B. Now, the curl of B is the current, and this is the charge. So what I get is, here is the current plus the time derivative of E. So putting everything together, we get, this is minus 1 over c squared d square E over dt square plus the Laplacian of E is equal to 4 pi gradient of rho times dj over dt. And similarly, I can also find 1 over c square of d square of b over dt square plus dB equals 4 pi over c curl of j. Now, the part that I'm most interested in is the left-hand side of this equation. These are the sources. The left-hand side contains this operator, is 1 over c squared d squared over dt squared plus the Laplacian. And this we call the box operator, which is the D'Alembertian, it's called sometimes. So it's the spacetime analog of the Laplacian. And we see that it appears with the c squared over here. So it knows about the speed of light. And in fact, it describes is the differential operators that defines wave propagation in three plus one dimensional spacetime. And we will see these in the next lectures. But it's the wave operator. So this is operator for speed c. So even if you have, no matter what kind of waves you are describing, this will be the speed of the wave. Even if it's not the speed of light, then it's not a Lorentz invariant operator, but it still makes sense as a wave operator. Now we would like to, since this object looks pretty much like, the Lorentzian square of something. So we want to introduce this object. So any questions up to there before I move on to the Lorentzian? So this is the Lorentzian version of the gradient. And of course, this box operator is eta mu nu d mu d nu. So that's why it is so nice. And we see that we have Ct over here and so with a unit of a distance. So this, we already, it's easy to see that if t and x transform with the Lorentz transformation, this will transform, so as a vector, this will transform as a covector, because these things are at the denominator in a way, and therefore they transform with the inverse, which is like exactly like covector should transform, and therefore this is a Lorentz invariant operator. As the notation suggests. Now, we want to revisit in this vein the continuity equation, because this also looks like a divergence, but with time and space put together. And so we notice that the continuity equation can be written as d mu j mu equals 0 for j mu equal 0 j. So what is j? J is a current density, so it means that it intuitively rho j is an object of the form rho times v. If in a small volume all the particle moves at speed v, j at that point is given by the charge q divided by the volume of this small region, which gives me the density times its velocity. So it makes sense. This is uniform in dimensions. So it makes sense to pack it up like this. And this is called the forecurrent. And now we can use a four-dimensional version of the divergence theorem to recover this conservation equation. So I go back to my figure. And introduce the four normal and mu to the boundary of my 3D region now. And this 3D will point downwards here, so it's minus delta mu 0. Here will point upwards, so n mu here will be equal to d mu 0. And here we have that n mu will be equal to d mu I n I. So basically is the normal that I defined. Maybe I should have called this S. So if I called it S, and I change this to be called S, just to avoid something having some weird notation. So that's the space-like normal, and is the four normal. So we get this relation at the three types, because this space-time region has three types of boundary components. Two space-like and one time-like, and so I have to introduce different notations for the three of them. And the normals must always be outgoing. So, outgoing normal. So if I now integrate, if I integrate this type of equation over the region M, and now it's a four-dimensional integral, what I get is by the divergence theorem, d mu and mu j mu, but dm has three components, as I say. There is r cross T0, then there is R cross T1, and then there is partial R cross T0, T1. So if I decompose this over its three pieces, I find integral over R cross T0 of what? J0, which is nothing else than rho. So this will give us Q. Sorry, T1 is the one up there, minus R T1, and we get minus J0 at the past. So there is an inverse. There is a sign in between the two because the two normals point in opposite direction. So this is future pointing. This is past pointing normal. Plus, we get the term at boundary cross T0, T1 of Si Ji. And this is precisely QR at time T0, QR at times T0 plus the flux. Sorry, the integral in time of the flux, dt. So we get back our equation from a four-dimensional divergence theorem. Okay. So there are a couple more steps in the notes, but again, if you have questions, just come see me. I just make these steps a little bit more explicit, but you can see that this is the integral in time and over the R of Sijii, which is precisely the thing that defines phi, for example. Next, we want to express the continuity equation in a Lorentz covariant form. We would like to see how to express the full Maxwell equation in this form. And it turns out that it's not that E and B are the three components of four vectors, but they are the elements of a rank two tensor that we now define. So probably all of these comes multiplicated by C, because here there are C's. So if you are careful about your C factors, everything is multiplied by C in this equation. F mu nu. So we introduce F mu nu, and if you remember how we did with the Lorentz, we decomposed the Lorentz algebra into this boost and rotation factors, and here we see a similar pattern for F. So we get 0 if mu nu is equal to 0, 0. Then we get minus EI, or EI if you get 0i, I0, and here is ij, and here we get epsilon ijk bk. Once again, the signs are important and depend on where I put these indices. If I put them up, these signs will flip. If I put one up and one down, only one of them will flip, and so on. So one has to be a little careful about that. But introducing this quantity, I can write the Maxwell equation in a more compact form as follows. So this will replace my two equations with sources. So is the equation 1 and the equation 4. And this is the other two. So this is the Faraday equation. So what does this symbol mean? This symbol means the following. Where something with indice like is defined as follows. If I have a mu 1, whatever a is, and there are n indices here, or p indices here, this is 1 over p factorial, sum over the permutation in, I don't know how to write the symbol, but is the group of permutation of p elements. Elements, then we put here the sign of my permutation, of sigma, and then we permute these indices. So m sigma 1 and m sigma p. So what does this mean? This looks a bit formal. Is the total antisymmetrization of these indices. So for example, a mu 1 mu 2 will be 1/2. A mu 1 mu 2 minus a mu 2 mu 1. If I have 3, I will have to put a 3 factorial, and there will be 6 terms, and every time I flip two consecutive symbols here, indices, I put a minus sign. So for example, let me write it like this. This is equal to itself, because this is already antisymmetric. So this is just to give an example. One can also introduce, we will also introduce the opposite bracket, a round bracket. And this is the same thing without the sign. So this is now completely symmetrized. Sigma p. And so in this case, the example is what it means to symmetrize these two means taking 1/2 of mu 1, mu 2 plus mu 2, mu 1. And the symmetrization of something totally antisymmetric gives 0. Now, since f is itself antisymmetric, it's q. What does this equation can be written a bit more simply. And this is an exercise that I leave for you. But this one, exercise using f mu nu q, prove that 3d mu f nu rho is equal, in fact, to the cyclic permutation between mu, nu, and rho of d mu f nu rho. This is quite a useful lemma that allows to simplify certain computations. So I can replace a total antisymmetrization, which is something a bit messy, by just cyclically permuting these three indices, provided that F is antisymmetric. So we will use this right now. From Maxwell equations, we get so how did I write? Oh, I wrote it like that. It's just new F, new. Right, so this is zero. This is identically zero because these are partial derivatives. They commute, but this is antisymmetric. So we have something symmetric in mu nu, which is just saying that d square dx mu dx nu is equal to d square dx nu dx mu with something skew in those same indices. And so this is identically zero. However, by Maxwell, this is Maxwell, this is 4 pi d nu, the divergence of nu. So again, this is a way to recover my continuity equation from the covariant version of the Maxwell equations. So what I did at the beginning over here, by taking the divergence of 4 and plug in the first equation here comes out in one simple step. This is the computation I've done up there. Similarly, for the wave equation, so this is one step, and now we want to find the wave equation. The wave equation. So which one should I use? Remember, there we use 3 and 4, so in particular 3. And so I can start from the Faraday law. And to start from the Faraday law, it's nicer to write it in that form. So let me start from, so this is Maxwell. I put a 3 because I would like to use that identity. Well, let me do it without. So this is 0 mu, and here I put my Maxwell equation, F mu nu rho. So this is 0 because of Maxwell, but this is also equal to 1/3 of that object. So we get d mu F nu rho plus, let's see if I want to. So now we get d mu f rho mu, or nu rho mu, and then we get d rho d mu f mu nu. By using our lemma over there. But this is nothing else than box. So this is 1/3 of box F nu rho. These, I can swap them. This is equal to minus F mu rho. And this is now the other Maxwell equation. So we get plus 4 pi d nu j rho. And here I get the same with a minus. And my indice is swapped. And so in the end, I could write this as 1/3, which is completely irrelevant because there is a 0 on the other side. F nu rho plus 8 pi d nu J rho. So this is just a rewriting. I'm using that formula there for the anti-symmetrization. And this equation is basically, where are they? Here. Is these two together. So this is box F mu nu plus 8 pi d nu mu, sorry, J nu equals zero. So this weird operation, the curl of J and these gradient time derivatives are all repackaged into this nice package over here. It's a good exercise to check it once to get used to manipulate these expressions, but there's no mystery. Now, yes?
I was wondering why we have the factor 1 over 3 there. Should it be 1 over 3 factorial or just 1 over
3? Here?
Oh.
Is these 3. So, Jackie helped me check this sign, so maybe she remembers how what was the reasoning. But if you write it explicitly, it comes out. But if there is a smart way to see why it's 3 and not 3 factorial, I'm a little less sure. So intuitively, the reason is this one, I would say. So here you have 1 over 3 factorial and 3 factorial terms. So it's like an average, an arithmetic average of all these terms. Here on this right-hand side, you get 3 terms on their own. So this is an average times 3 gives you 3 terms. You know, so each one of these counts 1, but here on the right-hand side, you have 3 of them. So there should be a 3. I think that's the most intuitive way of checking that sign.
Oh,
if that makes sense.
Cycling, and that is just permutation. So.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. So this is 1 over 6, 1 over 3 factorial of an average of 3 factorial terms. So it counts as one term, morally speaking. But here I just wrote the cyclic permutation without divided by. Or I could say 1 over 3 on the right-hand side. So it's also an average of terms. If you want, in case they were all equal, this should contribute. This should give just one term on the left-hand side and one term on the right-hand side. So if I put an epsilon instead of that weird combination of nablas and f, I should get epsilon on the left-hand side and epsilon on the right-hand side. Or 3 epsilon on the left-hand side and 3 epsilon. OK. OK, now one remark. This is very important. here, what we have done was to define this f mu nu as this package of e's and b's, wrote Maxwell equation in that form, then defined this nabla with 1 over c over there. So here we did a bunch of things, hiding a lot of stuff under the carpet, logically speaking, not mathematically. But logically, what we've done was to say the following. All of these works, so how to phrase it? So the fact that we can use, the fact that Maxwell equations, let me try just to say it in words and not write it. It's written more nicely in the notes. But the idea is that we were able to do this because the C that appears in the Lorentz group and Lorentz transformation is exactly the same C that is appearing in those equations. So of course, here I'm doing things backwards. But historically, one has started from those and essentially noticed that if one transform E and B's and X and T in a particular way, which translates to Lorentz transformation of f and x mu nu, then those equations would not change their form. This is a highly non-trivial result written in those variables. The point here is that knowing we can cheat because we kind of know where we want to get. So we've introduced these. We see here we introduce f in that form, and notice that those equations can be written like that. Now this is about a statement about what can be done in one particular frame. This does not say that physically things will be Lorentz covariant, but what he's saying is that if f mu nu, this array of E's and B's, transforms as a Lorentz two tensor, then it's manifest that this equation will be the same in all Lorentz frames. So in a way, this is tying the fact that we are able to write equations in this covariant form is a strong hint that E and B's should transform as a component of a rank 2 four tensor. So what I'm trying to say is that there is just a repackaging of our original equations that says nothing about how things should transform. And I'm just randomly choosing that symbol C to appear in certain places. Just for dimensional reasons, I noted that the right thing to do. But then I can write them in this tensorial form. And I notice that if I declare that, d mu will change, as we know, under Lorentz transformations. But if I declare that E and B transforms as components of this F, then things will be invariant. So originally, what people notice is that those equations are not invariant under Galilean, the naive Galilean transformations. Then you can try to fix them by trying to change E and B's in particular ways and try to, but there's no way to make these things consistent. And then it was noticed, if we do these weird transformations, then it works. And then things went on from there. But then it's, at the beginning, it wasn't quite clear whether this was how to interpret this result, whether it was a properties of the electric and magnetic fields, how they change in different frames, whether it is a physical effect or just. So this is what is clarified in the geometric picture by Minkowski and Einstein, is that all of these can be understood in terms of these Lorentz transformations, understood as space-time rotations, in a sense, like the changes of frame in space-time. But so I think I wanted to emphasize that by writing things in that way, we are we don't need to assume that f mu nu is a covariant object, but it's implied if we want this equation to look the same in all frames. So we are, in a sense, proving automatically the covariance of the equations under Lorentz transformation provided E and B transform a certain way. In particular, E and B, being components of a big tensor, will mix with each other under a Lorentz transformation. So So if I change a frame, E, and if there, so the let's think about an example. So we can take an electrostatic configuration in the reference frame K. So we have B and J are zero. And dt of E, dt of rho are also zero. So but E and rho are not zero, but they don't change in time. And there is no current and no magnetic field. So a charge sitting somewhere in space. Now, in a frame, in a boosted frame, k prime with respect to k, j will be rho v. Now, and things will stay static anyway, because this is a static situation. So there is no reason why but if you look at the Maxwell Ampere law, it will be clear then that we will need a B. So this is necessary. This fact that A and B mix is, of course, necessary given the sort of law we have written and the relation between the charge density and the current. So if a charge moves, and this can be a completely passive perspective, we are moving with respect to the charge, but we are seeing a current. So if we want Maxwell equations to apply also in the moving frame, then we have to introduce a B. But this B was not there before, so it means that E and B, in a sense, will mix with each other. Of course, one can also assume that these Maxwell equations are only valid in a specific reference frame. And this was the ether hypothesis, which is not so weird if you think that what they knew very well at the time was fluid dynamics. And in fluids, there is a natural frame, which is the rest frame of the fluid. So it was a very natural thing to think. It turned out that it wasn't the best way of thinking about this situation. And if you think about the Lorentz force, then it's quite, you can get to quite similar conclusions as this simple example of electrostatics and so on. Okay. Let me mention another few remarks about these So these equations actually make sense in all dimensions. Provided that F is anti-symmetric, is Q in its indices. That's the only thing we really need to generalize this equation to higher dimensions. Why we weren't able to do this with the Maxwell theory? Well, because there we have three E's and three B's. And so the natural way to generalize this would be to have five E's and five components for B. But this is not what is happening here. So what you would write there would not be Lorentz covariant in this higher dimensional world. Because in D larger than 3, or different from 3 in general, the number of component F0i is not equal to the number of component Fij. So, and this is the number of components of V and the number of components of B. So because we have a big anti-symmetric tensor, and so here we have E sitting here, and B is the anti-symmetric part of this matrix. So this is B. And if you count the component of an anti-symmetric matrix in three dimension, there are three of them, so we're happy. But in higher dimension, it will not be D. It will be it's easy to compute, but I don't have it on top of my head, like d times d minus 1 divided by 2. So those two numbers give the same result, only in four dimensions. So only in 4D, or in 3 plus 1 dimension, we have electromagnetic duality. As well as other nice properties like conformal symmetry in the absence of sources, but I will not say much about that.
Although,
yeah,
how to interpret the line that you said makes sense in all dimensions? The f mu nu, the commutator in the subscript. You said that's skew symmetry.
Oh. This is the totally anti-symmetric part of F.
Oh, okay.
So I can give you an A, whatever A, and that's its anti-symmetric part. So I can the easy example is the following. Suppose I have A mu nu with two indices, just two. And then I can write this as 1/2 A mu nu minus nu mu plus 1/2 A mu nu plus A nu mu. So this is the symmetric part, and this is the anti-symmetric part, and this is the symmetric part. And this is a decomposition of A. Now, in higher dimensions, those two parts do not exhaust all the components of A. But in for the rank 2 tensors, they do. But the point is that for any tensor here, I can extract its anti-symmetric components. And so here he's saying that the full thing is equal to its anti-symmetric component, so it's anti-symmetric. So this is skew. So if you try to solve this equation, you find that it's true only in D equal 3. And so and what does this mean? It means that in the absence of sources, or by adding magnetic monopoles, that is a source for the equation 2 in a sense, and a corresponding magnetic current. But let's say in the absence of sources, those equations are completely symmetric under swapping E and Bs, up to an important sign, but that's a different business. So. How do we write, formalize this idea in the relativistic in absence of sources? So if we take J mu equals 0, then we have that E is swappable with B. How do we write this in the four-dimensional language? Well, we have to introduce dual electromagnetic tensor, which is F tilde mu nu, let's write it like this, is equal to 1/2 epsilon mu nu rho sigma F rho sigma, where epsilon, this one is the totally anti-symmetric, completely anti-symmetric symbol. Completely skew symbol such that epsilon, and now I don't remember which conventions I use. Maybe I cheated by not saying it. Anyway, I don't never know if it goes up or down. It's one because if I take the indices down, there is a zero, so the zero coming down picks a minus. So. And all the other values can be found by the antisymmetry. So if I flip 1 and 0, I get the minus. If I flip 1 and 2, I get the minus, and so on. And if two symbols, two entries are equal, it will give 0. So this is what this is. And if you compute this, with that formula, you will see that we'll flip E and B's. And this is one important property of this epsilon. Is an invariant Lorentz pseudotensor. What does this mean? This means that epsilon prime, let's compute this. If I transform all of its indices by nu rho sigma by a Lorentz transformation, like this. Well, maybe I should have put the primes in the other place, but let's do it. Let's do it more nicely. Like that. What is this? Well, this is a formula you should absolutely remember. If you have an epsilon, this symbol, this anti-symmetric symbol, multiplied by matrices in that way, what you get is the determinant of the matrix times the symbol itself with the other indices. And this is true for any matrix that you put there. What is special about Lorentz transformation is that they have determinant plus or minus one. So this is invariant. So it's invariant under the proper Lorentz group, which is the part of the Lorentz group with determinant one, but flips a sign if there is a time or a parity reversal symmetry in lambda. And this is what this pseudo is about, is that here you can get plus or minus, depending on whether it flips with minus if orientation is flipped. The orientation of spacetime. So this minus over here is precisely what gives this this name pseudo. Pseudo, maybe pseudo invariant would be a better, it would be a better word. But anyway. And now you can see, you can play around with this f mu tilde and see that if you put a zero on the right hand side, if the Maxwell equation hold for f, they also hold for f tilde. But we will not do it now. We will do it from an action principle, because then it will be, is it? Well, maybe not. Maybe it's not much simpler. Actually, well, in any case, so one can say that this is equal to zero and this is equal to zero if and only if is equal to zero. And in a way, the trick is that these two equations are kind of swapped with each other. So we transform the divergence into this anti-symmetrized derivative and vice versa. This will be much easier once you will know forms, differential forms. This will be an easy thing to see. Right now, it looks a bit cumbersome. You can see that this is here. Probably the easiest way to see that is going backwards. So seeing where this equation come from, 1, 2, 3, and 4, and see that 1 is swapped with 2, 3 with 4. But 1 and 4 give this equation, and 2 and 3 give this one. So if I swap E and B's, I'm also swapping these equations. So this is clearer in a way in the non-covariant picture right now. But once you will use the form differential form language, this will be clear. Okay, then finally, the only equations that I have not touched upon is this Lorentz force equation. And it's an observation, if you want, that maybe finally the Lorentz force so we have that F is Q E plus V cross B, and this quantity is the space is the space component of F mu nu U nu minus. Okay, so if mu is equal to I, and you compute what this gives you this. So you put u equals 0, well, up to factors of gamma. Which work out once you write the Lorentz the force equation itself, but so u in the u will be gamma, so this gives qi0 gamma, which is q times e times gamma, and then the other one is gamma v, and here you get fij vj, but fij is epsilon b. So this is the cross product. So it's a easy to check. So this is what the Lorentz force is, and if you write the force equation dp over dt, and the reason there is this factor of gamma, in fact, maybe I should write it like this. Sorry, minus 1 over gamma. The reason is that if I write dp over dt, and I take this p to be gamma mv, and write it like that, this is really the same as, so maybe I should have written it in this form. That's dp over dt, this is equal to, is the space component of dp mu over dt of minus q f mu nu u nu. And the gamma that appears is the one translating p dot with the tau. Sorry, what am I saying this right? There is a gamma, as I was saying, 1 over gamma. But this is the same as p dot q f mu nu u nu because of the gamma is the conversion of from time to tau. So it's the time dilation. So this rightly compensate the fact that here I'm using t and not tau. And so this can be written fully covariantly in a way that is manifestly invariant and everything in this form.
So when you write p mu dot, you always mean dp d tau, right?
Yeah, the dot is always with respect to tau. So this is, this looks, the gamma is, sorry about this. I'm a bit confused about my factors of.
That's good.
Is the other way. It should be the other way because we want time dilation, but but it also works. So yeah, because we bring that here and this gives us theta. Okay, so now it works. And the last component, the time component, is the same as the mass conservation we mentioned before. So it's implicit, like this m, not the gamma. Okay, I would like, if there are no questions about this, I would like to conclude introducing the electromagnetic potential and rewriting Maxwell equations using that. So we will simplify them even more and find a nice wave equation. So maybe I go here. And so we can see that this equation I wrote here is the same as that one if we call this f. And now we will justify why we want to write f like that. So in fact, I would like not to maybe erase this. Well, actually, let me keep it. Oh, I have another blackboard that I use this one. Okay, so let's start from, let's go back to 3 plus 1. So we see also how it comes back out in. And let's take the homogeneous equations, those without sources. So these are 1 and 3 up there. So from this one, it follows that B can be written. So it follows that there exists an A not unique, such that B is equal to the curl of A. Now, if we plug this back in number 3, we have the curl of the curl. We have seen again that this is the gradient of the divergence minus the Laplacian of, I'm saying it wrong. So this is just 3 becomes. I was talking nonsense. So this is 1 over C dA over dt, equals 0. Now, if the curl of something is 0, it means that there exists a phi, again, not unique, such that E plus 1 over C dA over dt. Which sign do I want? I want a minus. Is minus the gradient of phi. So I want to write this as E as minus gradient of phi minus 1 over C dt of A. So this is just by looking at the homogeneous equation, I get the suggestion that, look, I can solve them identically and forget about them if I introduce an A and a phi. The price to pay is that these are not unique, because the curl of a gradient is identically 0, so I can always shift A by a gradient. and so this is the source of non-uniqueness there. And here is up to constants, but we will see later that it's E does not change because I can change this by a gradient and shift phi by the same amount. Well, by the time derivative of that gradient. But let's leave it there for now. We will come back to that later. And now we will see that we want to plug this back into 1 and 4. So these ansatz, well, it's not an ansatz. These the introduction of V, the introduction of E, sorry, of A phi solves 2 and 3, solves 2 and 3 at the price of non-uniqueness. G, A can be shifted to gradient, well, not it, i.e. can be shifted to the gradient of something, and phi can be shifted to minus the time derivative of that same thing. So this psi is arbitrary, and there's nothing we can do about it if we choose to use A and phi. So plug these into 1 and 4. And what do we get? We get now we get the curl of the curl, which is the gradient of the divergence and the box of the thing. So I spare you a longer story, and this becomes plus the gradient of an object gamma, and box phi equal minus 4 pi c rho plus the time derivative of the same gamma minus. So this is equation 1, and this is equation 4. where gamma is the divergence of A and the time plus the time derivative of phi. Now, from in this form, it's quite obvious that these read nicely from a Lorentz covariant perspective. If we put A and phi in one package, and then J and rho want to be, oh, here there is no C. J and rho want to be their own four vectors, so A and phi will want to be their own four vector, and this will be a scalar. So we have J mu is C rho J. A, now I need to be careful about where I put my indices. A mu is phi A, and gamma reads D mu A mu, and the Maxwell equation now become a box of A mu equal minus 4 pi over C J mu plus plus D mu gamma. And there is a minus sign here because this mu is indices up, so is 0 index up, so it takes a minus sign with respect to the 1 index down. What is the relationship between this E and B and F and this A mu? We also get that this implies that F mu nu is from those is equal to d mu a nu minus d nu a mu. So it's precisely what we wrote here. And that's precisely the Lorentz force we had before. Okay. Now, and this redundancy over here, which is called the gauge redundancy, is here re-expressed as A mu going to A mu plus nabla mu xi. And it's clear that this goes away because we get d mu d nu minus d nu d mu, the two partial derivatives commute, and we get zero. So it's clearly that f is invariant. Everything is invariant under this replacement. The advantage is that we can choose this parameter xi exactly to kill this gamma. So here we get that f mu nu goes to f mu nu. But gamma doesn't go to gamma. It goes to gamma plus box xi. So we can choose the xi to kill our gamma, to completely compensate for this gamma. And this means choosing the Lorentz gauge. So given A mu, choose xi so that box xi plus gamma is equal to 0. So this becomes xi of A. And then define a new A, let's say with an L here, which is defined as my original A. Now I need to think about the, I think with the plus, plus this guy. And this will be such that gamma of AL will be 0. And therefore, by construction, because this is what happens to gamma. And then it turns out that our Maxwell equation will read box of a mu. This special a mu we have chosen is equal to this. And so this is called the Lorentz gauge. Okay, so we conclude here, and next time we will study precisely this last equation I've written, box of A mu equal, I should be careful where I put my indices, equal to minus 4 pi J mu. Okay. And of course, f will not change. F can be computed. So if we solve, the idea is that if we solve for this specific a mu, we are happy because f does not depend. So this a mu is as good as any other. We have to check, of course, that when we solve this, we preserve this condition. OK, thank you.